Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Marc Goulet, and I'm a professor of mathematics and associate dean in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, your host for this program. Today, I'll be interviewing Ronald Meester, professor in probability theory at the Free University Amsterdam, about his new book, Probability and Forensic Evidence, co-authored with Klaas Slauten, statistician at the Netherlands Forensic Institute and a special appointment professor at the Free University Amsterdam. Dr. Meester is also co-author of the books Continuum Percolation, A Natural Introduction to Probability Theory, and Random Networks for Communication. Ronald, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So first I'll say a little bit about the book. The book that you've written addresses the role of statistics and probability in the evaluation of forensic evidence, including both theoretical issues and applications in legal contexts. It discusses what evidence is and how it can be quantified, how it should be understood, and how it is applied and sometimes misapplied. I look forward to our discussion today. So maybe to begin, you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in this field of forensic science and the intersection with probability.
Yes, I can give that a try. Originally, my PhD in mathematics in probability theory is long ago. I did my PhD in 1990. That was on spatial probability percolation theory, so that's very far away from forensic probability. And in that field, I've been working for quite some time. How do things go? At some point, and I vaguely remember when this was. I got interested in a court case in the Netherlands, where a statistician had written a report. And somebody had asked me, Ronald, can you have a look at that report? Because I have the impression that it is not so good, that there are problems with that. So that's what I did. So I looked at the report and there were problems and I spread the word about these problems. I got involved in the actual court case. I was actually a witness, an expert witness in that case. And that was sort of the start of my forensic career. And in the beginning, I mainly did my old probability things, but over the course of time, I got more and more interested in this branch, which I felt suited me quite well. For one thing, it was applied. So I like doing mathematics that means something. And that's very important to me. It has a very strong philosophical component. It's not only doing mathematics. It is also asking yourself the question, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? And how can we interpret the results? So over the years, this became my main research subject. And this eventually led to cooperation with a number of people, in particular Klaas Sloten. And at some point we decided that that the literature needed a sort of a standard work in this field. And so I hope we wrote that.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. You tell me a little bit about the writing of the book was a bit of an interesting process itself and the collaboration between you and your co-author.
Yeah, I mean, if you co-author a book of this size, you know, it is like 450 pages. There's a lot of material in it. It took us 4 to 5 years to write it. I mean, that is in many ways a very interesting experience, of course, not only mathematically, because, you know, when you set out to write a book like that, of course, you have an idea. You wrote a proposal for the publisher. And so that means you have thought about what you want to write. But, you know, the book also sort of writes itself. When you start writing, you bump into things that you thought you understood or you thought you had thought about before, but, you know, there are problems there. And so you start to think about that. So the book is not only writing, it's also sort of doing research at the same time. So from the mathematical point of view, this is already extremely interesting. But also, you know, I mean, such a close collaboration, of course, is also very interesting from the more human point of view. I mean, this is a nice anecdote, perhaps. I mean, I own a very small little second house in the east of the country in the Netherlands, and we went there very often for 2 days to work together undisturbed. And I think we did this like 30 times or so. So we took the train. We took the train to the east of the country, and we started to work there for two days, not doing anything else. And then after 2 days, we were tired and went back home. And you know, so we were very good colleagues, but you know, in the process, we of course became very good friends also. Obviously, that's yeah. So in many ways, it has been an enriching and very special experience.
Yeah, it sounds it. Thank you. Can you speak to why the subject, the use of probability in analyzing forensic evidence, is perceived by many as being so difficult?
Well, probability and statistics, of course, without going into forensic, is of course in itself already perceived as quite difficult by many. I mean, we do not have, most of us do not have a very good intuition for probabilistic thinking. And I have to say, even after all these years, I mean, I do not always trust my own intuition, right? I mean, so I'm not, you know, it's also possible for me to make mistakes there easily. But in a forensic and more legal context, one of the more difficult things is to ask yourself the question, what do I mean when I say that the probability of this or that event is so and so large? So maybe I can give you an example to illustrate what makes it difficult to understand what you're doing. Typically, when we think of probability, we think of these as predicting things, right? So if I throw a die, you predict how often it will land with a certain number of eyes up. In forensic context, I mean, the event of interest has already taken place. So there is a DNA profile found at the scene of a crime. So what does it mean to say or to even think about the probability that a potential person is the potential donor of the DNA profile? I mean, I've noticed that for many people, this is very difficult to actually to sort of understand that talking about probability even makes sense in that situation. So that's one reason why it is difficult. The second reason why it is difficult is just the fact, you know, ordinary logic, I mean, deterministic logic, maybe I should say it, of course, there are many types of logic, but, you know, classical logic is already quite difficult. But when you talk about probability, when there is uncertainty in the air, then things that you think are true are typically no longer true. Right. So if you say that, you know, I mean, if A implies B, right, then if you observe A, then you know that B must be there. But if there is uncertainty, things that seem true are in fact not true. And I've seen many, many people in the forensic and legal community make mistakes in that kind of reasoning. I've been teaching also this field to judges, and I know how difficult they find it, which makes, of course, the need for a thorough introduction, of course, only bigger. So I hope that answers some of your question.
It may be a little bit more on than your feeling about how improved understanding perhaps of probability and statistics can help us or help adjudicators in interpreting and analyzing forensic evidence.
Yeah, so maybe that I can maybe illustrate with a very concrete and very famous example. So maybe that helps to make my point. There has been a very famous court case in the United Kingdom in the late 90s. And this was the case of Sally Clark. And so what happened in that case, she was the mother of a three-month-old boy. And at some point she was alone with her baby at home and the baby died. And this was actually categorized as a crib death. Or right, so that sometimes happens with children, not very often, but sometimes it does. So of course this was a tragedy, but it was a tragedy and no more than that. But maybe you can guess, 2 years later, or maybe even less, I mean, yeah, something like 1.5 or 2 years later, the exact same thing happened with her second child. So again, she got a second boy, and again she was alone with the boy at home, and also the second boy died. And there were no indications whatsoever what could have been the cause. I mean, the cause of death has never really been established. So then at that moment, there was somebody, there was a medical doctor in England who computed the probability that this could happen to an arbitrary woman. And he came up with a number. I think if I recall, I think this was 1 in 72 million. So this is what happened. They claimed that the probability for this event to happen was 1 in 72 million if Sally Clark was innocent. And the judge concluded that this probability was too small to believe that hypothesis that she was innocent, and she was convicted. And she was convicted twice. That was remarkable. So one of my colleagues, Philip David in England, he argued that this small probability didn't mean anything at all. So the point is, yes, something very unexpected happened, something that had a very small probability. But that's completely irrelevant, right? What was not taken into account was the possibility or the fact that it is very, very unlikely from the outset that a mother will kill her two babies. So if you do a proper analysis of this, then you will see that there is no statistical or probabilistic reason to convict Sally Clark at all. And the judges and everybody else was simply misguided by this very small number, which they could not properly interpret. And so this was a very sad story. So she was released after a while, Sally Clark, but she died shortly after, and she never really fully recovered from the situation. So this is a very sad story, but it illustrates the need for proper probabilistic reasoning in legal and forensic situations. And, you know, this case, we analyze actually this case in some depth in the book, together with other cases. And so we hope that of course, that our book contributes to a better understanding of how you should go about in cases like this.
Yeah, that's a very important contribution. If in fact it does do that, Ronald, that's very good. Thank you for that example. At some point early in the book, for those acquainted with probability in general, there may be some understanding of kind of in their own mind or even in some others of the literature of various ways to interpret what a probability is, so to speak, kind of a definition or something you kind of try to wrap your head around. So these approaches like a frequentist approach or other kinds of things. You speak in the book about a specific interpretation, which is known as an epistemic interpretation of probability. Can you maybe say a little bit about to explain that? What is an epistemic interpretation of probability, and why, perhaps to follow on that, it's important that one adopt that particular interpretation when considering forensic evidence?
Yeah, that's a good and a very complicated question at the same time. So epistemic has to do with knowledge. So it's a philosophical question, of course. I mean, we're not talking about the mathematics of probability here. We're not talking about the Kolmogorov axioms and discuss whether they are what we want them to be or so. So epistemic probability refers to the fact that we are not interested in questions what things are. We are interested in what we know. So in more philosophical terms, we are not interested in ontology. We're not interested in the question whether, you know, is probability a physical quantity? Is that a physical, you know, property of certain things? I mean, that's not interesting for us. We are not interested in the question. That sounds maybe strange, but we are not interested in the question, does this DNA come from that person? We're interested in the question whether we can know that that's the case. That's what is forensic and what is legal science all about. Can we know that that's true? So that means that this asks for this specific way of thinking about probability, which in itself is a potential problem, because you have to somehow convince yourself and of course our readers that if we adopt such a interpretation of probability, that actually the axioms that I just mentioned, the axioms of probability, actually sort of still make sense, because we make computations with that, right? And most people would defend the axioms of probability by referring to probability as being frequentistic, in the sense, you know, a probability of a certain event is the fraction of times that event occurs in a long range of experience. And, you know, with this frequentistic interpretation, the axioms of probability make a lot of sense, and they can be very easily argue for. I mean, when you adopt a different interpretation like we do here, because frequentism doesn't mean anything in our branch, you know, there's only one court case for this specific case. And I mean, it doesn't even make sense to talk about the repetition in our context. So that means that we have to worry already in the beginning of the book about the validness of can we use the axioms? Does that make sense? And of course, we're not the first one to discuss this, obviously, but we had to address it in the book. And so we explain why this is a reasonable thing to do and why the axioms would still hold. And then once you've convinced you of that, then you can, you know, then you can just make computations with this notion of probability without all the time thinking what it means. Then at some point it just becomes mathematics again. But this philosophical step is really important and really necessary to address early. So our first chapter is really on philosophy of probability and forensic science.
Thank you. You spend a little time early on explaining perhaps how probability can be utilized to improve our understanding of a situation given some evidence, given some knowledge that comes to light. And you speak a bit in that context of some important concepts, odds ratios and likelihood ratios. And I know this is, we don't have a chalkboard with us here, Ronald, so I'm not looking necessarily for you to speak specifically to the equations. But I think the concepts are important enough for us to address and for you maybe to say a few things about those two concepts.
Yeah, well, that is certainly possible. I mean, the concept of a likelihood ratio is, I think, the most central concept of the book. So why is that? Well, this has to do with our philosophy of how to do statistics in this context. So I just give you an example. So it's very natural in this context to have two competing hypotheses, two competing scenarios. One by the prosecutor, and one by the defense. To make it simple, right? So they both have their own story of what happened, right? Of course, the prosecutor would say this person is the donor of this or that DNA profile, or he contributed to this mixture of DNA profiles, which is typically very often the case, and the defense would say no, somebody else unknown to us contributed to that. Okay, now, so then there's a piece of evidence. So the likelihood ratio does something very simple. It simply tells me, which of the two hypotheses explains this evidence, this piece of information, the best. So you can say, what would be the probability of this evidence if the first hypothesis would be true? And I compare that to the probability of that evidence if I would assume that the second hypothesis is true. Now, if the first probability is much higher than the second, that means that the evidence, you know, points towards the first hypothesis rather than to the second. And it is exactly the ratio, the ratio of these two probabilities that we call the likelihood ratio, and which, for the reason that I just tried to explain, we sort of interpret or we claim is the actual quantification of this piece of evidence in relation with the two given hypotheses. So the likelihood ratio tells me simply which of two competing hypotheses explains the data best. That's what it does. And this is a sort of classical way of doing statistics. This is associated to what is called the Bayesian school of doing statistics, and that sort of stands against the more classical Fisherian way of doing statistics. But in the context of forensics and legal issues, the Bayesian approach comes very, very natural for the reason that I just said, because, you know, there are two scenarios, there are two hypotheses at least, and it is very natural to simply see which of these two hypotheses explains the data best. And so that gives me the likelihood ratio. But of course, the story is not nearly as nice as I suggested so far, because the Bayesian approach to statistics also asks us to start somewhere. You cannot do statistics from nothing. So there must be some prior belief, some prior probability in each of the competing hypotheses. And this, of course, is something that very often mathematics has very little to do with. This is just, you know, this is just something that the judge or the jury or who else is is involved in the case actually has to figure out for him or herself. So sometimes this is taken as critic for the Bayesian point of view in doing statistics, because they say, well, you know, if I let me just compute the p-value, you know, then I simply have a number and that's it. And now you tell me that you have to combine this likelihood ratio with something that is called prior, and oh boy, this is difficult. Isn't this a downside of this method? And then I would say, well, it's not a downside of the method. It is a downside of what life is. This is reality. This is a much more realistic way of doing statistics than the old school, the classical approach via p-values. And yeah, there is a subjective element in that, but that cannot be avoided. So in explaining the mathematics of all this, we also try to convey the message that, you know, you can not come to a objective conclusion. That is simply impossible. And you may or may not like that, but that's what it is. And you have to come to terms with that. And that's a complicated message, of course. I realize that. I mean, this is not an easy story. I mean, let me also say that. I do not claim that the book is an easy read, right? I think you read parts of it, Mark. So you might want to agree with that. It's not something that you read in very short time. It requires an effort from the reader. But hopefully, hopefully you get something out of making that effort.
I believe so. I think it's a very good book, an important contribution, Ronald. You just mentioned a bit, and maybe we can circle a bit back on that, is you mentioned this notion of p-value. So to the listener who's a little familiar with statistics, of course, they will be familiar with this idea of a p-value. But maybe you can say a little bit your understanding of the idea of a p-value and why you in particular are a little cautious or ask people to be cautious in the use of p-values when analyzing evidence.
Yeah. That's in fact very important to discuss this, because we have noticed that many problems actually start with interpreting p-values incorrectly. So what is a p-value? A p-value essentially says, you know, how unlikely or how extreme, maybe extreme is the better word, how extreme the evidence that you found is with respect to the evidence that you could have found, right? So you know, if I draw a number between 0 and 1, right? Of course, every number is equally likely to be drawn, right? So there's nothing there. But still, you might find it a little unsettling if you choose 0.9999999999, right? Because it is so close to the boundary, it is so extreme, right? So a p-value tells me, if I would do this experiment many times, suppose I can do that, right? Then I would see a certain patterns of possible outcomes with certain probabilities. And a p-value tells me places the actual outcome that we found, it places that into the range of possible outcomes that you could have obtained. And that makes a lot of sense intuitively, right? Because, if you believe a certain hypothesis is true, but the outcome that you obtained is very extreme for that particular hypothesis, right? Then you start to wonder, wait a minute, is my hypothesis correct? And to be sure, this is exactly what happened in the Sally Clark case, right? Because, the hypothesis of being innocent did not match very well with two dead babies. And the probability of that happening was so small, you didn't believe the original assumption anymore. So it's a very natural thing to do. But unfortunately, the problem with p-values is that you need to know what kind of answers you could have obtained. So you need to know a lot about the actual experiment, and very often you don't know that. But even more importantly, so I just talked about likelihood ratios, right? So let me connect the two. So suppose you find a likelihood ratio of 1,000, for two hypotheses. That simply means that the evidence is 1,000 times more likely under the first than under the second hypothesis. So that's strong evidence for the first hypothesis in relation to the second one. So in a way, this is evidence in favor of the first hypothesis. But it can very easily happen that the corresponding p-value that you find, right, is extremely small. The corresponding p-value for that first hypothesis. So there is no relation, there is no mathematical relation between the strength of the evidence measured in likelihood ratios, on the one hand, and the corresponding p-value for, this, let's say, the first hypothesis on the second hand. And that's very worrying, because that means that you can compute p-values, but you know now that they have no mathematical relation at all to the actual strength of the evidence. And there are a number of reasons why this is so. And in the book, we explain some of that, hopefully in understandable terms. But let me add that today, as we speak, p-values are still used in the forensic context. So sometimes you see that people report the likelihood ratio, which is what they should do, but they also then add the corresponding p-value, which, in a way is essentially meaningless. if you have the likelihood ratio, then that's all you need, and that's all you can get in a way. You can also prove mathematically that, once you have the likelihood ratio, that's all that you can actually infer from the data that you have. All other information is superfluous. You don't need that. So adding a p-value will only obscure the picture, unfortunately. So we make a strong case for not using p-values as quantification of evidence. Sometimes it can be useful in the sense that you can discover via p-values that the two hypotheses that you looked at are both incorrect. That can, of course, happen. And that in that process, p-values can play a role, but only there. But again, you see that it takes a little trouble to explain this, and to really make this case requires a lot of care, and it requires a full chapter to really get down to the details and to make a convincing case, which I hope that we made.
Yeah. You spend a couple chapters around here, around the analysis of DNA evidence. And you say a little bit about that. Why is probability first such an important tool helping us work with DNA evidence? I mean, it seems that at some point you simply have a DNA profile and you have an individual that has that match or they don't. And so, you know, that seems to give some certainty. So maybe to discuss that a bit.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, of course. I mean, when you look at one of these, you know, these series like crime scene investigation or so, you know, at the moment there's a match, you know, then okay, we're done, right? That's it, and that's not how real life actually is. I mean, and there's several reasons for that. I mean, to be sure. If you have a full profile, which these days consists of like 28 places on your genetic material, then this should be essentially unique, right? So if you have a person with, then you can be pretty sure that he's the donor, he or she is the donor. Even that situation does not always lead to conviction, because very often the defense will say, okay, it's his DNA, but I've no idea how it got there. And then you have to prove that. But that's, of course, a slightly different issue. So let me give you two examples of situations where DNA and probability, I mean, are very, very interwoven with each other. So the first is what happens with DNA mixtures. That's a very interesting and very important subject, because it's very often the case that, for instance, blood of a victim is mixed with the blood of the criminal. And when you make a DNA profile, you can see the alleles, which means you can see the codes at certain places, but you do not know, you cannot see which code came from which. So you see it all together. You see like four numbers. Yeah? So at every place we have two numbers, one from your mother and one from your father. So if it is a full, if you see everything at that spot, you see four numbers, but you don't know which of the two belong to each other, right? So then you have to make a probabilistic assessment of the identity or of the different donors, and there are various techniques to do that. So there's a lot of uncertainty there that can be addressed in a probabilistic way. So that's one way. Another very important example, which abstractly is sort of the same, but I mean, from an application point of view, certainly not, is kinship analysis. So suppose there has been some disaster, like, you know, like the MH17 disaster, the plane crash here in Europe a couple of years ago, with many victims. Then you have to identify these victims. Or sometimes they're missing persons, just individual missing persons. And suppose you have DNA material of certain family members, let's say of a brother and a parent, let's say. So I know the DNA of the brother and the parent, and then I find the body somewhere, or I find bones or some other tissue, and then I want to know, does this belong to the missing person? And then it is a probabilistic statement, right? Because then you can make a probabilistic assessment of what you expect the DNA profile of the unknown person to be, given the DNA of the relatives. And then you can see if that matches probabilistically in some sense to the missing person. So that this kinship analysis is very interesting from a mathematical point of view. And it is one of the few areas in forensic probability where you can make actual computations, because we know a lot about the frequency of DNA profiles in the populations. So these are two examples where probability is very important in the assessment. And as a third example, is what you should do when you find a suspect via a database search of DNA profiles, which is an interesting subject in its own right. And then mathematics and probability becomes, I mean, unbelievably interesting, I would say.
Yeah. You spend a good amount of time on that, chapters 7 and 8 in the book, analyzing those problems. In chapter 11 of the book, so getting sort of towards the latter third, you discuss what is known in forensic science as the database controversy. And maybe for the listener, you can introduce us to that concept, and maybe a bit more difficult in a short interview, but some summary of your analysis of the controversy.
This has been a recurring theme in my forensic activities. The situation is extremely simple, and it will be maybe surprising to the listener that this simple-looking problem has caused so much uproar in the literature. I mean, even today. So here's the problem. So let me compare two situations, right? So suppose I find a DNA profile at the scene of a crime, right? And now there's two scenarios. In the first scenario, let's say I pick a random person from the street, right? And this person turns out to have the DNA profile that I found at the scene of the crime, right? So this makes this person, of course, in some sense, suspect, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one scenario. The other scenario is that the profile that we found, the DNA profile that we found at the scene of the crime, is compared to the available DNA profiles in some large DNA database. And suppose there is a unique match with a person, Adam Smith or so, or John Smith, we typically call him. And as a result of that match, John Smith becomes a suspect in the case. So these are two scenarios. And now the question is, in which case do you think you have stronger evidence? In the first case, which we call the cold case, where you simply pick someone from the street who turns out to have that profile, or in the second case, where the person actually was found through a database search. And intuitively, you can make a case for either direction, right? So the controversy, sort of circled around the question, which of the two scenarios gives the strongest evidence against the suspect? So one group would say, well, clearly this must be in the database situation, because you have also excluded a number of people because they do not match. So that means that we have a stronger suspicion against the person who did match, right? But there is also another school that claims that if the fact that you've compared to so many people, so how do I explain that in easy words? So the fact that I've explained it, that I have tested so many different hypotheses means, of course, that this suffers from what is called multiple testing, right? So of course, if you test enough people, at some point you will get some evidence that's to be expected. So the fact that you did so many comparisons weakens the evidence. And both can be sort of, what I sometimes do in my class is that I first, before the break, I explain to students that it is stronger evidence, and after the break, I explain it is weaker evidence, and then I leave them totally bewildered after that. It's not so difficult to give a very convincing case for either direction. So in the literature, papers started to appear, claiming either way. So Klaas and I, we thought about this carefully, and we sorted it out, and we explained what was really going on, and we explained that the whole problem essentially rested on some misunderstanding, and so we resolved this controversy in the book. for once and for all. So, in a way, the people that claim that the database search gives the strongest evidence are correct, but the reason that they are correct is not what was claimed to be the reason. But even 2 or 3 years ago, this was challenged by people who published something to the contrary again, and you know this is a continuing interesting story.
That's very good. That sounds in and of itself an important contribution, Ronald, to the literature. That analysis is this chapter 11 of the text.
I hope so. Yeah. given the amount of time we spent on it, I surely hope so.
Yeah. You and I share, of course, a similar mathematical background in the sense of probability and probability theory. And so something that comes up in the book towards the end, and I think relates to a lot of what we've been discussing, is that, probability, of course, we probably bias, a beautiful discipline, and it rests on a fairly surprising set of simple axioms, foundationally arrived at not so long ago, relative in mathematics history, right? Mid 1900s, Kolmogorov, axioms and understanding, but beautiful. But it seems in this area of forensic science and in evaluating evidence, we are often left with more uncertainty than we might prefer, and with even some things that are truly just, we should acknowledge we don't know. Sometimes the best thing to do is simply acknowledge something when you don't know it, And so you discuss in the book, and I know that there's more to discuss than what you write in the book, on a notion of it's not probability, it's a generalization of some kind, which was referred to as a belief function. So maybe you can say something to the listener for what is a belief function and why you find it important in this context.
Yeah, well, a belief function is sort of a probability, but it is a generalization of that, and it allows for certain types of uncertainty that I think, and with me many others, type of uncertainty that you come across when you look into legal affairs. Because in legal affairs, so let me try to illustrate it a little bit. Of course, you cannot convict anybody without proper evidence, without proper belief of the judge or the jury that the person that the suspect did in fact commit the crime. So this comes with evidence, right? So you need evidence. Now, in ordinary probability theory, if you know the probability of a certain event, then you also know the probability that it did not occur, because one of them must occur. So if the probability of A is 1/3, then the probability of not A must be 2/3. Right? That's how it is, and that's part of the axioms, and that makes perfect sense. But in legal affairs, it is quite possible not to have any evidence for the event that the suspect did commit the crime, but not having evidence at all also for the contrary. Right? So if you want to sometimes summarize your knowledge, and you want to express that in probabilistic terms, then you find out, I found out at some point, that I cannot express that within the axioms of ordinary probability. Right? So to give another example, which we call the island problem, suppose a crime is committed on an island and there are 10 inhabitants, and I know for sure that one of them did it. That's all I know. Then in classical probability, then I have to sort of, express my ignorance. I cannot really express my ignorance, because I have to assign probability 1 over 10, I think, to each of the 10 people living on the island, because that's the only fair thing that I can do in classical probability. But a belief function can do something very funny. A belief function can assign belief 1 to the whole ensemble of people, so telling me I know for sure that somebody on the island did it. But at the same time, it can assign belief 0 to each of the individuals. corresponding to the fact that I have no individual knowledge whatsoever, right? So sometimes the knowledge that I actually have cannot be described by a probability distribution, but it can be described by a belief function in the way I just tried to explain. And when I figured out, this was one of the hurdles that I came across many years ago. And then there was some colleagues of mine who said, well, maybe what you're looking for, this might exist. Maybe I think it is called a belief function. And that opened a new world for me. So I studied them thoroughly, and I redesigned some of the theory. I re-derived conditional belief function, everything that is needed to work with that. But there is a genuine applied reason to use them. It is not some mathematical, artifact or something that I like in mathematically. It was something that I actually needed. This chapter of the book is I think the most theoretical of all and the most mathematical of all chapters. And the application of belief function in the forensic world, it starts to grow. There are also philosophers now who actually claim and who defend that idea. So that has been a real, real pleasure. Think about that.
Yes. Yeah, grounds for further research and further investigation. It seems to perhaps provide an interesting perspective on allowing one to assign things you might suspect in terms of probabilities on certain ensembles of elements, so individuals, but not on individuals or not on other ensembles.
Right.
Depending on things that are presented to you.
It gives a lot of freedom. I mean, right. there's a lot of different types of information that I can now now process. And I could not process that, with classical probability, which was a tough thing to swallow, of course. I mean, you can understand that, I was raised as a classical probabilist, probably like you, right? this took some time to mentally be able to do that. But after a while, it's as natural to me as classical probability is.
Yeah, you do a good job in chapter 13, Ronald. You do a very good job, I think, at laying out even some of the mathematics behind it. And I think in articulating that this can still be done with care and lead to, of course, sound conclusions, sound mathematics. One can still carry a certain program through, even without, as you've mentioned, or as you can speak here, without a so-called additivity of property. In the final chapter of the book, I believe very important, you make suggestions, some guidelines. You propose some guidelines that would assist forensic scientists and adjudicators in interpreting forensic evidence. So perhaps for the listener, summarizing those guidelines.
Yeah. Well, the subject is difficult. I mentioned that a couple of times before. So over the years, some so-called recommendation reports have appeared. There is the PCAST report to the President of the United States. There is the European report of a whole consortium of forensic institutes. There is an academic report that was the offspring of a meeting in Cambridge, and there are a few more. So we thought it would be interesting to see how these recommendations actually align with our own conclusions. I mean, so you expect, of course, a recommendation report to be correct, that they tell you how to apply certain things and how to do and how to avoid mistakes and what to do and the do's and the don'ts, so to speak. But to our surprise, we read very carefully six of these reports. Two of them were very good. In the sense, of course, we had some comments because they were not perfect in all places, but we did, but these were very reasonable and very useful. Two of them were downward. I mean, they were downright, I mean, wrong. on the statistical part. And some of these reports also, I mean, discuss other branches of forensics that we do not discuss, but on the forensic parts, they were downright wrong. So that was and is very harmful. So we pointed out what goes wrong in these reports, and two of them were, you know, somewhere in the middle. So with some good and some bad advices. So this was something that, well, we had not expected it to be this way, to be honest. It came as a mild shock to us. That recommendation report written by professionals could contain, very important mistakes. So we explained in some detail. Of course, we did not discuss the reports in full detail because these reports by themselves are sometimes, 100 or 150 pages long. But we report some highlights and invite the reader, of course, also to draw their own conclusions by reading these recommendation reports. But this last chapter, actually, this was not planned in the beginning. And to be honest, it was our publisher who convinced us that this should be a very good service to the community to do this. And he was very, very right. So this was one of these moments that a publisher can have a very important, input in a book that is being written. So this was a very good suggestion, I really appreciate it. And of course, it took us a lot of hours to do that, but it was worth it.
So to reiterate, it was Cambridge University Press. Is the publisher of the text. Again, it's Probability and Forensic Evidence. Concluding, to ask, currently, what are you up to? What project or projects are you up to now?
Several. So my forensic activities also led to a more general interest in statistical methods. So I'm also writing on statistical methods in general, and more the philosophy behind that. And this goes as far as to really try to understand, for instance, how, for instance, something that you might not expect in this context, but when you go to theoretical physics, to particle physics, whenever, let's say, the Higgs particle was discovered a couple of years ago, but not many people know that this was a statistical proof. Using p-values, and I told you before that I do not like p-values. So this of course sparked my interest in what the hell was going on there. So I'm looking into that with theoretical physicists. So that's a very interesting project that I can really. Don't worry, I think the Higgs particle is still there, but I think there's a better way of conveying that. So I'm for instance looking at that. I'm also writing a somewhat more popular book now on the use of mathematical models when it comes to policy and politics, which of course has been very important over the last few years in the pandemic. So I'm working on that. And there are always several forensic mathematical problems that I work on. I have no problems in finding very interesting projects to work on and projects that I think are worth pursuing also, of course. Yeah.
Yes, that sounds, it sounds it. That's very good. Besides the Cambridge University publishing website itself, Cambridge University Press, do you know another way where the listener could find a copy of the book or more information about you and your work?
Well, you can always look at my homepage. If you Google my name, you come to my homepage quickly. So then you can find my list of publications, for instance. And you can buy the book in any bookshop or online. It's generally available. It is hardcover, but there's also a softcover, so the paperback. So they're both available. So it should be no problem to actually find a copy if you're interested.
Well, Ronald, I want to thank you on behalf of the New Books Network. And personally, it's been a delight to speak with you today about the book. I wish you well. We'll talk again.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay.
Bye.
Bye.